Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
My guest today is Ken Monshine, who is the writer of Game of Thrones and The Medieval Art of War. And he has the kenmonstein.com. Sorry if I screwed that up a little bit. But today we're going to have an interesting episode. As the new show, Host of the Dragons, came out, we're going to discuss parallels in real history that inspired Game of Thrones, as the title of this episode says. Because there's a lot of parallels and quite a significant lot that is George R. R. Martin got inspired from the show that casual viewers and not necessarily history buff like myself have thought about. And before we start with that, I want to ask, how did you end up studying the medieval era in the first place?
Everyone asked me that, and it's kind of like my own particular autism, I guess. It's my own particular little obsession. So it's something I've been into since I was a little kid and sort of organized my life around it. So that's how it came to it. You know, I grew up in New York City and we had a bunch of medieval museums or museums of medieval art. We had that rich people brought back to the States in the late 19th century to show, you know, that they were as classy as their European aristocratic counterparts. And you see it, and it's sort of like something from a world apart, and it's very, very different from my kind of, you know, working class upbringing. And then also it was a bit of escape from, you know, the concrete and asphalt of New York. So I've been sort of obsessed with that sort of thing since a very young age.
And a lot of people pointed out, both me and I think in general, that like you said, there's a lot of parallels to real world history, medieval history, as Martin, that is Martin's obsession as well, I think. And we're going to dive into that now. And a friend of mine pointed out to me that, you know, the Targaryens, we agreed, pretty much are the Normans. But the first men are kind of the Celts, right? And the Andals in the show is kind of Anglo-Saxons. Is that correct? Is that a correct analogy?
I mean, yeah. I mean, to whatever extent that these are, you know, these labels that we give these ethnic groups are, you know, because this is all like 19th century historiography. I don't know if, you know, the Picts and the Celtic peoples, and remember they were it's not quite parallels, because remember the Celts of Britain had been a Roman colony, and so they were sort of they're Christianized and Romified, but Martin has them as sort of like pagans, you know, in a very romantic sense, and so they've been Christianized and Romanized. But and then, you know, these successive waves of invasion clearly inspired, but also kind of fits into this sort of neat 19th century ethnogenesis, I think. Which is a little inaccurate in some ways.
So let's talk about the Targaryens here, because as you said, they are Normans. And I don't think it was the current Viserys, but his father, or was it grandfather? I'm not quite sure that he is kind of more or less a William the Conqueror. Is that correct?
Well, that'd be Aegon, right?
Aegon. Yeah.
But of course, it was a very different situation between William the Conqueror, because it was actually a succession question. Whereas the way Martin framed Aegon's conquest, it was a bunch of different things. And, you know, it's almost like more like the conquest of Ireland with client kings and getting like involved in things. But this was, you know, and Blackharren and Harrenhal and all these different things. So it's not quite the same parallel. There's a bit of invented history there, but what's interesting to me about the prequel book, right? The, you know, the whatever the heck it's called, so My World of Ice and Fire, and it's related material. What really strikes me is that he wrote it to have the sound of a history, that he's got these sort of invented primary sources, you know, various chronicles and accounts and things like that. And that's sort of like how we do history, is we read these primary sources, we read these things, and we, you know, we read these things, and some are more or less trustworthy. And, you know, Martin has his invented Septim Eustace, and then Mushroom, the court jester, who's like almost like a little Procopius, the guy who chronicled somewhat unreliably Justinian Theodore's court back in the 6th century in Byzantium. But, you know, he's playing at these sources as sort of unreliable narrators. And so it's a nifty little invention, because he's not just inspired by history, but by history writing.
And that, yeah, it was fascinating. I haven't read the book, the prequel book. I read the first book, but I haven't read the prequel book yet. I plan to. But, you know, it's interesting. That's why we have the time jump in the show, right? Because it's written like a chronicle. And that explains why we have this time jump in the prequels, right?
Yeah. Yeah, this is that time jump, you know, like in real life. And that's like, I find the time jump to be very interesting, too, because it's a risk for the showrunners, because, okay, they've established these actors as playing these characters. And the question is then, can these other actors embody those characters in such a way that it doesn't mess with the suspension of disbelief? So it's a bit of a narrative risk, but it's very interesting, because you've got like 5 episodes with the one actors, and then you jump and you got the different actors.
So what else from the Targaryens can we see that kind of mirrors? We agree that they are more or less the Normans, but is there anything else we kind of can see that they mirror real life?
Yeah, except of course the Normans, you know, definitely had more of a central government. There was less leeway for a large, you know, for not entirely, right? But you did have, you know, things like roving kings, justices, and things like that. A little more leeway to the various great houses in Westeros. But the Targaryens, I mean, what's interesting is that the Dance of the Dragons, right, which is the subject of the subject of the prequel series of House of the Dragon, that kind of mirrors the Hundred Years War. I mean, it's not between, you know, two different countries, but the whole thing is set off by a question of, can, you know, you inherit, well, in real life it was, can you inherit through a woman, right? Edward's grandmother, I believe, was the daughter. But there's also, you know, there's those questions. And then, of course, it's essentially a civil war for power. And then, of course, you know, the War of the Five Kings and the main line of you know, Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones, that is in many ways inspired by the War of the Roses, where you had different contenders for the crown. So certainly, you know, there's a lot of historical inspiration there. Of course, Martin's a big history nerd, but of course, you know, one has to say that this, of course, is not history. History doesn't always resolve the neat little narratives. To be fair, you know, Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones isn't a neat little narrative, but it is a, you know, but it's definitely takes a lot of inspiration. I wonder if the reason why is because certain stories keep recurring, right? Or simply that just the plot twists in history are so, you know, just so inherently interesting. And, you know, maybe it's the callbacks. Certainly history nerds like enjoy the callbacks, but also I think you can find a lot of good narrative ideas and a lot of good story ideas in history.
Imagine William the Conqueror riding over Britain with a dragon.
I'm sorry?
Imagine William the Conqueror riding over Britain with a dragon.
Yeah, definitely William the Conqueror and, you know, Aegon, you know, William the Conqueror, Aegon the Conqueror, certainly they are parallels in some way. Of course, you know, William's conquest of England didn't start off a whole new dating system. And of course, you know, William did not conquer Scotland, which I guess, you know, the North is Scotland, right? It doesn't hold true, but certainly in some ways, Westeros is medieval England writ larger, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I have a Game of Thrones risk version myself at home. And when you look at the map, you can clearly see that it does resemble Britain quite a lot in the map, even though it's, and I think it's the same as we look at the map of Westeros and Google, right? It does really resemble Great Britain.
Yeah, in some ways, right? It's this big mass, but it's bigger. And you know, I think that's just so Anglo-centric, right? In the sense that, you know, that you know, for Americans and for British people too, like, you know, there's an old British headline, fog and channel, continent cut off, right? And this, just like, there's nothing, but, you know, everything is jolly old England, and people are like, oh yes, we're sure there was some French medieval history in there too, but of course you look at all the media, like the French and the Germans and the Italians are just, you know, people with funny accents.
Yeah.
So it's a little, it's a little bizarre. So,
But so since the Targaryens again are the Normans, does that technically make the Baratheons slash the Lannisters the Plantagenets in some way?
Plantagenets.
Are they technically the medieval, the Game of Thrones version of the Plantagenets? I'm sorry if I said that wrong.
I mean, those came from the Normans. Well, they were the Plantagenets came from, you know, from Anjou, right? And they actually took, you know, they took over in 1154, so it was actually, you know, not, it was actually quite, you know, quite a bit after. And he control, you know, it's not quite the same. I don't think the Plantagenets are the right way of looking at it. I think a better way of looking at it would actually be, there was actually before the Hundred Years' War, right? It was Henry IV. I think a better way of looking at it would be, you know, if you Henry IV of England, Henry Bolingbroke. Who they were related, of course, through John of Gaunt to the royal line, but, you know, he and you know, he wasn't completely outside of that, right? But
yeah,
the Baratheons were, you know, just one of the great houses. But it's more, I think it's more similar to that, and of course, then, you know, Henry, you know, Hen- then there's Henry the Fifth, right. And then, you know, Henry the Fifth was rather popular, and he succeeded by, Henry the Sixth. And then, of course, when, you know, after he dies, then, you know, we got Edward the Fourth. And then after Edward the Fourth dies, I'm trying to remember all of them, of course. And Andrew the Fourth, you know, came, you know, the question was like, you know, who's going to succeed, Henry the Sixth, and a whole bunch of different things, like the big succession crisis. You don't really, you do have episodes in the War of the Roses where, you know, the exiled king he's exiled to France, and he comes back and takes over, right? And this happens, you know, in history too. Like there's the after the deposition of James II, there was, especially in what do you call them, the Stuart loyalists, right?
Yeah.
What do they call them? Stuart, Jacobins, right? From Jacobins, from James, of course, the Jacobins. So I'm sorry, my brain is not.
That's fine. Don't worry.
I went through a bit of a personal tragedy, and my brain is not firing on all cylinders. So
that's fine. Don't worry about it.
So, yeah. So that's what happened. Anyway.
So, yeah, let's talk about it'd be interesting, the beginning of Game of Thrones series. And I haven't read the prequels, so I can't really talk too much about it, and it would kind of spoilerish as well for the show, so don't want to go too much into the prequels right now. But let's go with the start of the show and then the Dothraki clan. We talked about this before the recording, we started recording the podcast, and you said I said I have a real mongrel kind of vibe from the Dothraki. Is that I'm a way off here, or is it more or less right?
Yeah. So the Mongols, I mean, he said that, you know, to some degree they're inspired by the Mongols, also by Native Americans, Great Plains Native Americans like Cheyenne or the Sioux. But I think in a lot of ways the Dothraki and this sort of like, I mean, it's sort of like this romanticized, like ultra-violent society, isn't it? Mm. In many ways, I think of them as also inspired by like the Hell's Angels or an American biker gang.
Mm. Yeah.
They're like, you know, almost like a criminal syndicate of Central Essos. So, and there's a lot to that because, of course, and they don't, you know, Martin doesn't really go into the details of Mongol society, which is really interesting. Like the men, yeah, they made war and rode horses and hunted and shot bows and wrestled. But the women did all the trade and the economic activity. And he doesn't really kind of show that. He's just he makes it such a patriarchal, male dominated society without really looking at how important women and women's economic activity was to that society. Mm. So you can't really say, you know, without that, you can't really say, oh yeah, it was based on the Mongols, whereas the Mongols had this very unique social organization.
But it's more or less Mongols, right? The Westeros, free cities game version of the Mongols, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it is kind of Westeros / the free cities version of the Mongols.
Yeah. I mean, very romanticized in many ways. Mm. So,
and something I kind of thought about, but I think it was Crassus, the one that faced the Spartan rebellion in ancient time, and a few episodes in the first season with Ceres, Daenerys' brothers.
Spartacus. You mean Spartacus, right?
Yeah, no, Marius Crassus, the one who defeated Spartacus, the Roman senator, and.
You said Sparta.
Never mind.
Not actual Sparta in the Peloponnese. Yeah.
So Viserys, he in the first season, I think it's Viserys as his Daenerys' brother. He dies with a golden when he wants stolen crown and the Khal Drogo. He pushed his mail scrolled and he put over his head. Is that a reference to kind of Crassus' death? Because he dies in the same way, don't he? He dies. With I don't remember who the name of the tribe that does this is the Battle of Carrhae, I think. They pulled melted gold over Crassus's face, and he dies that way after he is defeated in the battle. I think. Is there a connection here, or?
I think it's just like, because you know he was his head was like. Cut off, right? Mm. He was actually killed in sort of a skirmish, right? Which were with the Parthians, right?
Yeah.
So it's not really you know that was I don't know, was someone anyone like actually killed? I mean it's I'm sure it was actually happened, right?
Yeah. I think that there were. I'm pretty sure. I'm not quite sure it was Crassus though. There was a Roman senator. I remember. I think it was a part. I think I'm pretty sure it was Trusses. I'm not quite sure. I could be wrong here. You're probably right, but not just a
Manius Aquilius.
Yeah,
yeah. Who Manius? Well, Manius Aquilius, right?
Yeah.
Was killed. He was of course. He had that happen to him by Mithridates the sixth of Pontus had molten gold. So there was that, right? And then Valerian supposedly was executed that way. But yeah, it sounds good, right? That just sounds just really sounds all normal, right? Also, like a Spanish governor in 1599, apparently. I'm just Googling this, and Ecuador had that. So, this is, yeah. So,
at least Viserys got his golden crown, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it'd be a horrible way to die, right? Mm. Yeah.
There was a lot of a horrible way to die in the medieval era, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, they thought of all sorts of wonderful ways to kill people. Mm. It was pretty horrible.
So something that, you know, as we see, and I'm going to do a little bit back and forth in the show as well. There's a lot, of course, a lot we have to discuss here. And something that we see, and I don't remember the battle in the Game of Thrones, I think it's season 2 or 3, I'm pretty sure. That's where Joffrey has to be a general of the battle and they use dragon fire in the show. That's a and at the end, that's a resemblance to Greed Fire, right? Which the Byzantines had that kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, that is without question a reference to, well, not Joffrey. Yeah, I mean, it was more Tyrion, right? It was doing that. Mm. The Battle of Blackwater. Yeah, it's definitely a reference to Greek fire. And, you know, they used that to great effect, you know, in the Crusades and elsewhere. It also was an anti-ship weapon. Of course, the sort of their magic Greek fire burns, you know, is even more horrific than the original version.
Mm.
So, but yeah, it was definitely inspired by real life. Again, just, you know, stuff is really, really, really bad.
Yeah.
You know, people can do really bad stuff.
Is the battle itself an inspiration of anything, or is that just pure fiction, the battle I've seen,
I mean, anything really, if you think about it, the storming of Constantinople, you know, the attack of Constantinople during was it the Fourth Crusade when the Venetians took it? But yeah, there's all sorts of especially the whole chain across the bay. It took a lot of inspiration from historical battles. All of them really do. Of course, there's a lot more battles in Game of Thrones than there were in the actual Middle Ages for reasons I discussed in my book.
Yeah.
Because, you know, medieval warfare was essentially, you know, siege warfare was very important.
Hmm. No, so something, I mean, you thought about this as well, and this is not Game of Thrones, but Tolkien would, of course, be an own episode of his own, but I think it was, and at the end, it's been a while since I've seen the Lord of the Rings, but there is the battle in the second book, the final battle. I think it's the one where the orcs. That's the one. Yeah, that's inspired. That one was inspired by the 1453 siege of Constantinople, right?
Yeah, I do think it was in many ways. The difference is, I mean, the orcs pull up this big battering ram, right? But of course, you know, they've got Gandalf and, you know, there's Nazgul. And of course, you know, unlike in Constantinople, like, you know, the relief force arrives. That's what actually happens. But of course, Constantinople was not just cannon fire, but also direct siege, right? Direct direct assault. So, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought to mention that briefly as well. I thought it was kind of interesting and sort of relatable to the episode. But something that I kind of thought about as we discussed this, and I wanted to bring this up, is that the Night's Watch in, I think she thought it was the girl. It's been a while since I've seen the show now, and I do apologize for that. But the world in by the end of Westeros before the Wildlings, is that kind of inspired by Hadrian's world? It has to be, right? Yeah. It has to be Hadrian's world.
He very, very clearly says it is, like this whole idea of this wall at the end of the world, right? And then it's almost like a prison colony, but they really have something of like a military order about them too. So, yeah. So they really have something of like almost like a crusader order or something about them too. So I find that really interesting that they do that. Yeah, it's a good. He puts together a bunch of things, but it's it's very creative in a lot of ways. Sorry, mind wandering again. The way he does that. Yeah, he's very
And I just thought of this, and in later seasons we see Arya visiting Braavos in the Three Cities, and we would come back to the Three Cities as well, where she meets up with this faceless gang and she trains with them. Are they kind of the assassins and Islamic sect during Saladin's time? Are they kind of like the assassins?
In some ways, I mean, Braavos itself really, of course, is very Venice. It really, you know. Smells of Venice, but the faceless men, I mean, they're just this kind of like, you know, they're really weird, but yeah, they do. I mean, any assassins, and they are assassins, is going to remind us of the Hashishi, who were actually come from the a Shia sect called the Ismaili, or the Twelvers. Who did have almost millennialist beliefs about the bloodline of Muhammad and the return of the return of a descendant of Ali, but they are in this case their religious cult based around gods of death. So you know, they're a cool little fantasy world, because obviously, you know, the Hashishi didn't put on different faces, and of course they're named actually from using cannabis an ecstatic state, supposedly. So obviously the faceless men don't do that, but they do a whole bunch of other stuff. But they are kind of like this sort of like ultra, you know, they're kind of ninja in some way too. I mean, you gotta say, like, okay,
tried to assassinate Saladin at some point as well, right?
Saladin, yeah, and you know, just a bunch of stuff like that. Yeah.
Sorry, you were going to say?
Yeah, that's it.
And while we're talking about Islamic history in Game of Thrones, the Daenerys, and I do not remember what they're called again. I'm sorry if I'm really poor at remembering the names sometimes, but she gets us this slave army at one point in the show. Daenerys, and I kind of feel like, are they inspired by the Janissaries or Mamluks? Somewhat.
In some ways, but also, I mean, I can't think of any historical eunuch armies, but certainly, you know, in some ways, Janissaries. But yeah, there's definitely this sort of like vaguely. I mean, the thing is about the East, right? That in many ways, Essos is a very Orientalist creation, right? There's an old and rather racist expression in English, the wog start in Calais, wog being an old and rather racist term for anyone not white. And here what they're saying, basically, you know, we're the British, we're the English, and everybody, you know, from France on down is basically weird, you know, some weird Easterner. And like you can even extend that sort of racism to Italy or even Spain. They're too Oriental, they're too Southern, they're Latin. Yeah. So this whole idea of the East, right? This whole idea of, you know, that's where they're eunuchs, right? They castrate people, because there's a lot of castrate in Westeros too. But this whole idea of like a eunuch army, they do sort of smell like Janissaries, but also, you know, eunuchs were
I mean, they train from children, right? They're castrated as children. They train from, that's all I know, the soldiers. And the same with the Janissaries and what was supposed to be a Mamluk army, which kind of was an experiment go wrong, you can say. And it kind of feels that they were, kind of a Janissary core of the world of Game of Thrones.
Well, the Mamluks certainly like this, military slavery, right? But they were also there's a lot of interest, there's a lot of interesting aspects to that of but the whole castration thing, right? The whole eunuchs, right? Eunuchs, I'm more interested in the fact that they're eunuchs than the fact that they were so then they're a slave army, so they're a slave eunuch army. Nothing like that ever existed, right? No one would do that. But there were eunuchs who were, harem guards and things like that, that they were sort of, domestic enslaved people in China, in China, in the Ottoman Empire and elsewhere. And yeah. So, yeah.
And also while we are on the free in the, on the side of the free cities, there are you mentioned that Brow is a kind of Venice, and the whole free cities are kind of inspired by medieval Italy, right? There are several they are there it wasn't united until the war in the 19th century, and it's kind of like Venice, like you said, Brow is which and the different cities that we see, they are kind of medieval Italy, right?
They are, and like the especially like the mode of warfare with like these mercenary companies. So, yeah. So like these were these mercenary that's I find that very interesting. Yeah, I mean he takes a lot of inspiration, right? The whole idea of a sellsword. And so the essential disunity there. And it's funny too because they're presenting like Westeros is maybe more unified, but really, Italy wasn't really more or less disunified than the rest of Europe, and so, at least in some periods, right? In some cases, a little more. But yeah, they, large kingdoms started, we hindsight's 2020, and large kingdoms appeared in France and, in England. In Spain after Ferdinand and Isabella, right? These sort of more, centralized monarchies, if you would, but not so much in Italy, but it's also partially because Italy was, besides having these various dynasties that had their own city-states, and this traditional Italian disunity, but of course they were also, the battleground for the rest of Europe in many ways, from this, late 15th through the 16th century and on.
And of course, we have to talk about the elephant in the room and some events of the show. And there are some one I want to begin with, which I think you know which one I mean, the infamous Red
The
Wedding.
Red Wedding, right, with the
So
black
with that's
hair,
yeah,
right?
that's inspired by the Scottish event, Black Diner, as you said. So let's talk about the Red Wedding for a bit, right? How did it take inspiration from? And that's still controversial to this day in Scotland, right? The Black Diner, it's still controversial to this day.
No, it was a very, it was, the heads of the Douglas clan were killed, right, by James II Stuart, James II of Scotland, right? He wasn't, this was well before he was crowned James II of England. And I mean, sorry, James II, James II, let me, I can look it up, but James II of England was what number of oh, he's James VII, right? He as of Scotland. So this is, five Jameses period previously in the 15th century. Come and dine with me, and they kill him. So yeah.
So what and Geoffrey himself, he has to be inspired by some real
Joffrey?
Geoffrey, King Geoffrey,
Joffrey Baratheon. Yeah,
Yeah,
well,
he has to be inspired by some monarch, right?
psycho kids. I mean, he's sort of a Caligula, really. I
Hmm.
think he strikes me as like a Caligula or even a Nero. But no one was really. I mean, remember their view of Caligula and also of Nero was very influenced by Suetonius, who was a hostile later chronicler. And so, like, we can't really know. You know, was he really that bad, or was he just trying to, adopt sort of like an Eastern style Roman emperorship, which didn't really take off till like really after, really after Vespasian. But yeah, he's got more of a Caligula feel to me that because I don't think any medieval monarch would have been tolerated to be so frankly, nutso and decadent, quite not quite as much, but also, there's a great deal of invention there because, well, the kid's a sociopath, right?
Yeah.
So, but it's all for the sake of storytelling, right?
Now, something that I thought was probably worth mentioning as well is that Jon Snow in the Westeros, in the sorry in the, I don't from in the North bastards, and he explains this in the book as well. He in the first book at least, the bastard would be called Snow, and then they would be called I don't something else in
Flowers
the
and
otherwise.
flowers or
Yeah,
stone, yeah.
what's this like the like it in the real world medieval era as well, and
Well,
pretty much up
they
to date that bastards would be called something.
well, you got to realize people didn't have surnames in the Middle Ages, right? That's more, you'd be like James, Tall James or other James or James for across, from the other side of the river or James Franklin or James, from Lincoln, right? So something like that. So the entire idea of having a surname, right, and family names, and that's it. But you got to remember, most people didn't really have surnames. If you're a well-born bastard, then you might actually have like estates settled on you, right? That people who were like, bastard, acknowledged bastards of rich people. I mean, poor people didn't necessarily need surnames. And of course, you take your mother's surname in later times. If if you were married, you'd be assumed to be to your father. The woman's husband would, of course, be assumed to be your father, like in paternity tests. But no, that never really happened. That's it's something fanciful. I think the biggest mistake is that people think that people from the Middle Ages had surnames.
I was going to say something. I just had it's on the tip of my tongue right now, and but I just seem to forgotten it right now. But if there is, let's end it here, I think. And before you go, is there before. Where would if you had a chance to live in Westeros, if where would you live if you had a chance?
Someplace with running water and soap. Probably. I don't know. I mean, could I even survive in Westeros? Do I have the knowledge of things? Would my knowledge be useful? Would I make a living? I guess someplace where I could, survive and make a living, but, with whatever small skills I have. I think that a lot of people think that they'd do very well in the Middle Ages. Oh, I'm a handy guy. I can put stuff together. But really, you wouldn't be in the Middle Ages because a lot of what you know how to do is contingent on modern technology, right? Could you can make furniture, but can you make furniture without power tools? So much of this is so much of what you know how to do is not suited to the medieval ness.
I'm reading a book as five volumes set on the history of Norway right now, and I'm on the 8th-19th century, and it's a lot. I'm currently reading about diseases, and even in the 19th century, there is a lot of like diseases, a lot of it wasn't really comfortable. Children had to work from morning till evening on night shift, and I'm pretty sure you should be happy living in the era in the 21st century, because there's a lot of things I think we take for granted that we. Even if you go back for 100
Antibiotics.
years, it was still not kind of a miserable place to live in, more or less.
Antibiotics and shit, right? But Antibiotics, safe childbirth, anesthesia. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of things we take for granted that we don't, that we have in today's world that we probably couldn't live without if we traveled back in time to the 19th, even as far back as 19th century, unless you became a rich aristocrat, you know, somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you know, we still have more material wealth, you know, you and I as middle class people living in the West. Yeah. Yeah. People, you know, in the West, like we actually have more wealth, more material goods than even medieval kings, just because, you know, the productivity of our economy is so much higher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So before you go, do you have, thank you so much for coming on. Do you have, where can people buy your book if they are interested in reading Game of Thrones and the Medieval Art of War, or find your website if you wanted to put it in the description? Is there any links, any social media where people might find you that you want me to put in the description?
Yeah, sure. Ken, my website's kenmunshine.com. You can follow the links, get to my books from there. My Game of Thrones book is Game of Thrones and the Medieval Art of War. And you may also be interested in my book on the history of timekeeping technology and concepts on time, published by Johns Hopkins University Press.
Thank you so much for coming on this show. It's been a pleasure to have you on and talk about real events that inspired Game of Thrones. I hope you liked this episode. If you did, check out some of the other episodes. There is plenty of episodes I'm sure you're going to find interesting. Please like, share, and subscribe. If you're on Apple iTunes, please consider leaving a review. That would help us out a lot. We are on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. And now please like, share, and subscribe again, and I'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.